Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Xfinity Mobile, featuring customized wireless plans. Customers can choose unlimited, buy the gig, shared data, or a mix of both and switch it up anytime. Learn more at xfinitymobile.com.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Health Dialogues. On today's program, disordered eating. It's everything from bulimia to binge eating to anorexia, obsessive behavior where people literally starve themselves.
The psychiatrist there, he was straight to the point. He would say, like, Lydia, you are too skinny. You look terrible. And when you gain weight, you are going to look fabulous and everyone will love you.
Eating disorders are not always taken seriously, but as we'll hear, they should be.
These disorders can be extremely serious medically. Not only can patients die from malnutrition, but they can also have irreversible long-term medical consequences.
The triggers, signs, and symptoms of serious eating problems and what friends and family can do to help. I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is Health Dialogues. We'll get started right after this. It's Health Dialogues. I'm Scott Schaefer, and this hour we're looking at what's called disordered eating. We all have our food likes and dislikes. That's totally normal. But when those preferences slip into extreme obsessive-compulsive behavior, leading to huge weight gain or weight loss, well, that's a serious problem, especially when it happens in adolescents or young adults. We begin this hour with 16-year-old Lydia Gustav-Werthen. She talked to us about her long battle with anorexia nervosa, a disorder where people starve themselves and become severely malnourished. It took 5 hospitalizations before she beat the illness.
My name is Lydia. I am 16 years old. I go to the Harker School in San Jose. When I entered junior high, then I guess I was more aware of how there were a lot of skinny girls and they all had boyfriends. And so I stopped eating lunch. I started exercising more. I kept a food diary eventually. And I would calculate, like, how many calories, how many grams of fat were in each food, every item of food I ate. When I looked in the mirror, I saw an overweight girl. I lost a lot of hair. I skipped my period for about 2 years. My nails were very brittle. I was pale. I was just severely underweight, so I was put in the hospital for the first time when I was 13. My dad found out about it first. I was coming out of school and waiting for him to pick me up, and when we got in the car, he drove me straight to the hospital. I used to go on pro-anorexic sites. It used to be, like, one of the main things I did during the day when I was staying home and recovering, or supposedly recovering. I felt safe when I went on those sites. I felt like someone understood me, and I felt like someone else knew my secret. I was sent to a residential center. I was sent to a mental hospital. And then from there, I was sent to the eating disorder ward in the hospital in Berkeley. The psychiatrist there, he was straight to the point. He would say, like, Lydia, you are too skinny. You look terrible. And when you gain weight, you are going to look fabulous and everyone will love you. And I hated how honest he was, but at the same time, I loved it. It was so motivating for me to get better, and it was great. They would talk to you during your meals about how you felt about the meal. I would cut up my food into tiny pieces, and I remember they gradually took me through this process of slowly cutting my food into bigger pieces, into not having to cut it at all. I was really nervous when we came home also, because I was transferring into a kind of partial hospitalization after that, where you'd have breakfast and lunch at the hospital, but you'd come home for dinner. And the first day, I didn't want to get out from my room. I kind of slowly walked down the stairs and said, you know, I don't really want to eat dinner. But so my dad just said, okay, well, sit down and talk to me. Just talk. Say anything you want. And I did not go back upstairs. I stayed downstairs for dinner. I ate everything on my plate. I feel so powerful that I've come to this point in my life. Like, If I'm having a hard time at school or thinking about a test, then I just remind myself, like, Lydia, if you conquered an eating disorder, you can do anything.
Lydia's story was produced by Shuka Kalantari. People with disorders like Lydia's can get help at Stanford University. We visited the campus recently to talk with two physicians who tackle the physical and mental health aspects of disordered eating. Dr. James Locke is the psychiatric director of the Comprehensive Eating Disorders Program at Stanford, and Dr. Seth Ammerman, he's with the Division of Adolescent Medicine at the Lucile Packard Children's Hospital at Stanford. I began by asking Dr. Locke to comment on that story we just heard about Lydia's struggle with anorexia and how common her symptoms were.
Lydia had anorexia nervosa, and in general, her story is really consistent with what we typically see. She's a person between 12 and 15 years old. Usually it's a girl. She begins to think about her appearance and her weight. She changes her behaviors, and in certain kinds of kids, they actually do exactly what she did. They get extreme about it. And most people can't get that extreme or be effective at being that extreme. She could.
And is it the kind of thing that happens over time? Is it gradual?
Actually, her story is a little unusual, and she talks about starting her concerns around age 6. Usually it happens a little more quickly than that. In fact, that's one of the problems. Symptoms can develop at, you know, beginning of school in 7th or 8th grade, and you can be very sick by the second semester of that same year. So there's a quick shift in weight and weight loss and behavior that takes everyone by surprise.
And is there a trigger for it?
There are lots of triggers. There are a lot of psychosocial triggers that people have identified. Maturation with puberty, social concerns around adolescence and appearance. The media presents images of attractive women being very thin, men being very fit and slim. So those are the kinds of triggers we typically think of, and kids will report them.
Now, Lydia's problem was anorexia, but there are other kinds of eating disorders, binge eating, bulimia, and so on. Of those three, which is the most common?
Binge eating in adolescence is not too common in its own form, where you're just binge eating. That usually onsets in young adulthood. You may have some binge behaviors earlier, but that's a bit later. It is probably the most common of the disorders in adulthood. In adolescence, bulimia nervosa usually onsets a little bit later, maybe 16, 17, anorexia about 13, 14. Bulimia is about twice the rate of anorexia, which is a little under 1%, and bulimia is 2 to 3%.
And just to describe the differences among those disorders, if you would.
Well, anorexia is a disorder where the preoccupation is around lower and lower weights, trying to maintain an extremely thin, unrealistically thin body, such that your physiologic needs and health needs are compromised. In bulimia, you have a pattern of wanting to lose weight for the purposes of appearance, but you aren't able or you don't continue to lose weight dramatically. Instead, you get starved and then you binge eat. And in that process, you overeat in a short period of time, feel out of control, feel terrible, and then you want to get rid of that. And you purge it either by vomiting or exercise or taking laxatives, that kind of thing.
Is one more serious or more difficult to treat than another?
Anorexia appears to be more physically serious and concerning. It is more difficult to treat as well. The determination of a person with anorexia is informed by a belief that they don't have a problem. We call it egocentric, meaning they actually think that we're all wrong. They're actually fat, and we're telling them they're thin, and they don't have a problem in their view. The bulimic person actually realizes that often they don't like these behaviors. They feel trapped by them. They want to have changed their appearance. They don't really like having to binge and purge to try and accomplish these aims. So there's more traction for change and motivation for change in the bulimics, and that makes them easier to treat on average.
Dr. Ammerman, anything you want to add?
You've been talking about specific names of eating disorders like anorexia nervosa and bulimia nervosa and binge eating disorder, but there's a large group of young people who may not meet the exact criteria for anorexia or bulimia, but engage in these same behaviors that Dr. Locke was talking about, and they can be equally dangerous and medically compromising. And
like what?
Well, for example, to be diagnosed specifically with anorexia nervosa, you have to have no period for 3 months in a row, and you have to lose a certain amount of body weight. And you have to say that you have a distorted body image, essentially. And patients may meet one or more of these criteria, but not all of them, so we can't actually diagnose them as anorexia. But the behaviors they're engaging in terms of trying to get to that extreme point that Dr. Locke was talking about can be equally dangerous in terms of the weight loss and malnutrition that lead to the medical complications that we see.
It seems that most people with eating disorders are women, but how common is it among boys and young men?
So in anorexia, it's 90% girls and about 10% boys. And in bulimia, it's probably about 15% boys. They are majority female illnesses. Actually, once a boy presents with an eating disorder, in terms of the behaviors, they're really similar.
Now, how do you distinguish between like a diagnosis, especially for, say, bulimia, versus, you know, an athlete, for example, a wrestler, a high school wrestler who knows that they need to lose a certain amount of weight to get into a certain wrestling class, a weight class, which seems more rational in a way?
Seeming rational is one thing and being rational is another, and it does in the minds of wrestlers. It's a good example. Wrestlers will have a very set of sometimes very destructive behaviors, not drinking, trying to dehydrate themselves to lower their weights, throwing up stuff and so forth. Also, they're a group at risk, as are gymnasts and a number of other athletes at risk, because their weight actually does affect their performance. Those behaviors, if they become habitual, that's going to lead to the disorder. They're dangerous anyway and shouldn't be done, and coaches should be looking out for that and should just like they would for steroid use or any other inappropriate way to manage developing the body that you need to be able to compete. This would fit into my mind that same category.
Dr. Immerman, there's a perception that many have that disorders like anorexia and bulimia are really most prevalent in middle-income, upper-middle-income families. Is that accurate?
No. Eating disorders really can affect every ethnic, racial, and socioeconomic group of people. We've in the hospital at the inpatient program at Packard Children's Hospital, we've had migrant farm workers' kids who are Latino. We've had African-American patients. So one of the things that I do is that I'm the medical director of a community outreach program sponsored by Packard Children's Hospital. It's a mobile medical clinic that targets uninsured and homeless youth. We remarkably see a lot of kids who have disordered eating in this population, which is low income and even homeless. A colleague of mine and I, Dr. Rebecca Peebles, we did a research project also with Dr. Locke. We surveyed over 100 kids in our mobile clinic program, about half of whom were homeless. And we found that those who were intensive internet users had much higher rates of disordered eating, abnormal behaviors such as binging and purging, using diet pills and using laxatives. And this is a population which is very underserved and disadvantaged.
And what's that connection between the internet and those behaviors?
That's a good question. We think that, in part, the kids who spend intensive time on the internet are looking for answers to questions about body image, specifically for the eating disorders, about their behaviors and body image. And this is, in one sense, they're often their only source of information. And a lot of the information on the internet is misinformation, as we know. Yep. One thing I do want to talk about and make sure we get to is just the medical complications, because these disorders can be extremely serious medically. Not only can patients die from malnutrition, but they can also have irreversible long-term medical consequences, including abnormal growth. Girls can become infertile. They can have abnormal bone density and end up having bones at the age of 15 or 20, like a 50 or 60-year-old woman. And some of these problems are irreversible if the disorder goes on long enough. So the medical consequences are quite severe. And when kids are hospitalized for these issues, they're often in shock because they've been out exercising and running around, and all of a sudden we have them stuck on a bed and on a cardiac monitor because we're worried about their heart failing.
What is the therapy, the kind of mental health therapy, psychotherapy that works?
For anorexia specifically, this has been a challenge. Just to put this in context, this is a disorder that was described 150 years ago in the medical literature. We have had in the world literature only in adolescence about 600 kids ever studied in treatments. About half of them have been studied here at Stanford, as it turns out. We've been using a treatment here and studying a treatment here where families are assisted in trying to help their child recover from anorexia nervosa. The families are not blamed or made responsible for the cause of the disorder. In fact, the opposite of the case. They're taught to actually manage the problems that anorexia nervosa is presenting, the really severe dieting, the overexercise, the social withdrawal. All those processes, the family is helped with a therapist to learn to manage. This has been shown to be, as far as I know, the only evidence-based treatment we have for anorexia nervosa. And it's really effective for patients who are found within the first 2 or 3 years of the onset of the illness, their adolescence generally. And after that, frankly, if you move to adulthood, we don't have any really good treatments for anorexia nervosa. Turning to bulimia for a moment, the best evidence treatment is cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a therapy which has been used for depression and anxiety and OCD. And it's been studied pretty well in adults with bulimia nervosa. Actually, we have only 2 studies ever in bulimia nervosa in adolescents that have been published in the world literature, 120 kids, even though the behaviors onset and the disorder onsets in this age period.
And let me just stop you. So cognitive behavioral therapy is helping people think about things in a different way.
Well, cognitive behavioral therapy is this. It's, first of all, helping people experiment with changing their behaviors and looking at the effects, and then changing their cognitions by challenging them in the context of behavioral change. So it's a graded kind of intervention where you're working with both changing binging and purging people's dieting behavior, asking them to keep food records, think about what they've done, analyze how they've moved forward with that change, and then trying to gradually change that behavior over about a 6-month period.
What advice would you have, Dr. Ammerman, for families, for parents and siblings and friends even, you know, to be on the lookout for some of the behaviors or some of the changes, you know, that are warning signs?
Well, I think parents, as in so many other adolescent issues that come up, just need to check in with their kids on a regular basis about how they're feeling about themselves, about how things are going with them. If parents are starting to notice changes in the kids' behavior, going on diets or seeming to overexercise or withdrawing socially, at first sign, parents should check in with the kids and really keep a tab on what's going on.
Dr. Locke, anything you'd add to that advice for parents and families?
Well, just a little more specific things about some warning signs that would get me worried and I'd want parents to think about. The first is if there is a radical shift in a developing kid's diet. Are they really saying, I'm not going to eat things I used to like, and they're really perseverant in it? Second, if you notice that they're going to websites to look at dieting materials, if your kid begins to take a shower, think about, why are they doing that? Well, they go there and they throw up in the shower. It's something to take note of. The hardest part is that can happen so quickly. You know, parents are really busy and kids are really busy and, you know, you're making sure they're getting to whatever they're doing and their school and everything. And you'll say, well, whoa, I didn't notice. And a grandparent or an aunt or uncle will come and say, whoa, what happened to her? She looks like she's so scared. And the parents who are accustomed to seeing her every day do not see this. So you'll get some feedback from people sometimes at a sporting event who haven't seen your child for a while or a relative and says, what's happened there?
Well, gentlemen, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Physicians Jim Locke and Seth Ammerman from Stanford University. To hear a conversation between Lydia, the girl we heard at the beginning of this segment, and her father, go to our website. You can also see photos of the teen health van in action. That's at healthdialogues.org. As we heard a few minutes ago, binging is the most common form of eating disorder, especially among adults. And yet, it's hard for people to get treatment for it. That's because binge eating disorder doesn't have a formal diagnosis like anorexia and bulimia do. So insurance companies often won't cover treatment. Kelly Weiss reports on efforts to change that.
It took a long time for Jamie Lieber to figure out how to treat her binge eating disorder. She says she realized her relationship with food wasn't healthy when she was a young, competitive gymnast, and then it intensified when she went to college.
I just experienced a lot of anxiety being in a new place, and food was my go-to.
She saw a psychiatrist and got medication to treat her depression and anxiety, but she says that didn't eliminate her binge eating habits or the guilt and shame she felt afterwards.
You might start with something that you really enjoy eating, like ice cream, and it might turn into you just start having all these other cravings, you know, maybe bread and butter. Things that, you know, you're just craving more carbs, and then you're craving fat, and then you're craving sweet, and then you're craving salty. And before you know it, you're not even eating things you really like.
Ann Lieber says periods of binge eating continued after college.
The quality of my life really was not good. I was isolating myself. I wasn't dating. I was missing out on living.
She says in 1 year, she gained a lot of weight and started having a chronic cough and painful reflux. So she went to see a family doctor.
I was just craving someone to help me.
But she says he didn't mention anything about her weight gain.
And that's when I said, well, you know, I gained 50 pounds this year. And don't you think this might have something to do with that? And he said, yeah, it probably does. But it was, again, very quickly rolled over and not really addressed to the degree that it was the root of the issue.
Lieber says she then decided to make it her life mission to become healthy. She started doing yoga, became a practitioner of Chinese medicine, and incorporated a balanced diet. Undergoing psychological therapy helped her learn how to manage her anxiety and binge eating behavior, but she says she knows it will never completely go away. So if she notices she's turning to old habits, she'll use her tools to get back on track.
People will not lose weight until you address the underlying issue.
That's Dr. Tom Hopkins of Sutter Medical Center in Sacramento.
Because binge eating disorder can be associated with stress, depression, anxiety, joint problems, gastrointestinal problems, you know, weight gain is another, of course, accelerated weight gain. And that's, that binge eating is driving that. But you got to ask the question.
Hopkins knows this because he specializes in bariatric medicine, the study of obesity and weight loss. But Hopkins says even though binge eating disorder is prevalent, most doctors don't know how to treat it.
It is the most common eating disorder, period. So you're going to see, you're not going to have these patients go to eating disorder clinics. No, this is a problem that is presenting every day to medical practices that is not being addressed.
Binge eating disorder is almost twice as common as other eating disorders, but still, psychotherapist Jennifer Lombardi says it's hard for people to get help. She's a co-owner of the Summit Eating Disorders and Outreach Program in Sacramento.
When it comes to coverage for treatment, people who are struggling with anorexia and bulimia, it's much easier for them to have access to treatment financially than it is for somebody struggling with binge eating disorder, which really doesn't make much sense.
Lombardi says since her center opened 10 years ago, there are more patients today with binge eating disorder. She says stress from the economic downturn is driving many people to binge eat, and several patients are younger than before, some 8 years old. She says more than half of people she sees with binge eating disorder won't get treatment because it's not a formally recognized mental illness.
So the eating disorder section, you can see there's a diagnosis, a formal diagnosis separate from any other diagnosis for anorexia. And with bulimia, it has its own separate diagnosis.
She's looking through a large book called The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's used to diagnose mental illnesses, but binge eating disorder doesn't have a specific listing. And that means most insurance companies won't cover treatment. She says many people can't afford to pay several hundred dollars a week for therapy out of pocket. Lombardi calls this ironic and says if America really wants to tackle the obesity epidemic, Binge eating disorder must be recognized.
I think in a sense, culturally, we're speaking out of both sides of our mouths. We're saying it's a major problem, and yet at the same time, we don't have access to treatment for people.
The American Psychiatric Association, or APA, makes the changes to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. A new one is scheduled to come out in the spring of 2013. And the chair of the APA's Eating Disorders Workgroup has recommended a specific diagnosis for binge eating disorder. For Health Dialogues, I'm Kelly Weiss in Sacramento.
Still to come, how too much of a good thing can lead to a different kind of eating disorder when a healthy diet goes too far, and how perceptions of our own weight might not match up with what others see in us. I'm Scott Schaefer, and you're listening to Health Dialogues.
On the March edition of Health Dialogues, we look at medical mistakes. Consumers Union, a nonpartisan advocacy group, estimates that thousands of Californians die each year from errors and infections. Join Health Dialogues as we explore efforts to reduce these risks. That's next month on Health Dialogues.
And welcome back to Health Dialogues and our exploration of eating disorders. I'm Scott Schaefer. Well, even eating healthy food can lead to serious problems when the diet becomes compulsive. Some experts call it orthorexia, and it can include a compulsion to overexercise. Orthorexia doesn't appear in the official manual of mental health disorders, but as we hear from Crystal Smith of KPCC in Los Angeles, it's real, and the internet is helping to fuel it.
Here goes a day in my shoes. I would eat breakfast, put on so many clothes just to sweat, like 10 layers. And then I would go run about 10 miles. And then I would come back and do about 800 push-ups. And then my next meal would be like a Greek yogurt with watermelon. I'd go run it off.
That's Hannah. She's a former ballerina who at 21 has lost so much weight that she can no longer dance. At 5'2", her weight hovers near 70 pounds. Her clothes drape loosely over her body. Her nails have all fallen out due to malnutrition. She uses exercise and so-called healthy eating to keep her weight at a decidedly unhealthy level. Think of it as a more modern permutation of anorexia.
They know every fat gram, everything, every calorie. They know more, a lot of times, than even the dietitian, because they have read and they have studied.
Dr. Rebecca Cooper runs Rebecca's House, just outside of Los Angeles, where Hannah's being treated for her eating disorder. Cooper's seen a steep increase in a specific subset of eating disorders that the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual has yet to recognize as an official diagnosis. Being obsessed with healthy eating, what some experts are calling orthorexia, is anything but healthy. It can involve a fixation with a certain type of food, such as oatmeal, to the exclusion of others, leading to severe malnutrition. As you heard from Hannah, it can also involve exercising to an extreme.
I like the phrase exercise bulimia because it really describes what's happening, and that is it's a form of purging using exercise. It's a way of getting rid of extra calories, and that's your motivation for exercising. I mean, I've seen people actually exercise themselves to death.
For Hannah, life had become an endless cycle of eating and exercise.
I know that you only need one workout a day, 45 minutes, and you're good to go, but I feel like after I eat, I have to go run it off, and I'm just exhausted.
These days, the demonization of carbohydrates and the rise of highly restrictive diets like the grapefruit diet have made out-of-the-ordinary food restrictions mainstream. Psychologists point to the internet as a potentially dangerous source of information on calorie burning, exercise tips, and extreme dieting. Dr. Cooper.
There are sites that are called Pro Ana websites where they actually have tips on how to lose weight. They put pictures of who's the thinnest, and it's all about cheering each other on to lose more and more weight. So it's kind of like a little club that is so dangerous.
Writer Katie Drummond was so alarmed by the information she found on healthy eating blogs that she decided to investigate some of the bloggers.
With social media, you have these blogs where there's visual reinforcement. There are sort of photos of what these diets look like, and then those diets are celebrated. And certainly women are made to feel like that's something to emulate, that is a positive thing. And then as far as exercise goes, one blogger would announce that she planned to do 26 marathons before her 26th birthday and plan to strength train with a specific plan that she put on her blog 3 days a week, and sort of had 80 or 100 women comment below that saying that they were going to start doing the same thing.
This set off alarms on both personal and professional levels.
I have a background of recovering from a very serious eating disorder, and I noticed that as soon as I started reading these, I felt that sense of wanting to exercise more, eat less, emulate these women. So just my own sort of gut reaction told me that this was probably a larger issue, and that there were probably other women who would be affected the same way I was affected.
The fallout from an investigative piece Drummond published in Marie Claire magazine last year was immediate. What she calls a vicious Twitter attack ensued. How dare she call into question these harmless blogs with tips for healthy living, asked devotees. On the other hand, many women thanked her for highlighting an issue they were personally caught up in.
There's an undercurrent there of women who are really, really struggling with eating disorders. And this one woman, at least, had to stop blogging entirely and sort of just pull herself out of this community because it was so damaging to her health.
Dr. Jen Berman specializes in treating eating disorders with private clients in the Beverly Hills area.
Unfortunately, it's like giving the drug to the drug addict for people with eating disorders. And they have really harmed the health of so many people who have attempted to recover and unfortunately have found a place where other sick people will co-sign their unhealthy belief system. And that really oftentimes contributes to the demise of someone's health.
However, Dr. Berman says the solution does not lie in demanding that these sites and blogs be blocked or censored. Rather,
where the responsibility comes in is the ill person and the treatment team of that person. And as part of the treatment, oftentimes someone with anorexia, bulimia, or orthorexia is told no more internet.
For Hannah, the former dancer, restricted internet access and a moratorium on exercise will be integral to her recovery. The biggest obstacle left is her internal struggle with body image.
It's the fear of blowing up. I'm just afraid I'm going to be fat. But I know I can't live like this anymore. I just want my life back.
For Health Dialogues, I'm Crystal Smith in Los Angeles.
To hear an extended interview with Hannah, the patient in this story, go to our website, healthdialogues.org. People with eating disorders often have a distorted view of how they look. Despite being too thin, they may think they're overweight. But researchers are also finding that many people who are actually overweight, even obese, don't see themselves that way. Sarah Varney reports.
Daisy Say looks down, unappetizingly, at a plastic bowl filled with fake lettuce and cucumbers. She's pregnant with her second child and getting a lesson from a nutritionist at San Francisco General Hospital about how to eat better.
Ayer me dijo que comió la ensalada.
Sí.
Con
un poco de dressing.
Sí. Sí. Está bien.
Daisy tells the nutritionist she ate a salad yesterday with un poco de dressing, just a little bit of dressing. That's good, the nutritionist says, and urges her to eat even more vegetables. Daisy's been overweight since she was a kid, but while she wants to be healthier, she says she's better off than the rest of her family.
Pues incluso es lo que también tenemos nosotros, que por ejemplo,
my aunts are heavier than me. I also have two cousins that are much younger than me, 22, 23. They're really heavy. That makes me think that even though I am overweight, I do not think I'm that bad.
It's the modern equivalent of keeping up with the Joneses. As more and more Americans have packed on the pounds, being overweight, even obese, has become the new normal.
Among overweight and obese women, they think they are normal weight.
Mahbuba Rahman is an obstetrics and gynecology researcher at the University of Texas. In a survey of some 2,200 reproductive-age women in Texas, published recently in the medical journal Obstetrics and Gynecology, Rahman found that a quarter of overweight women considered themselves to be normal weight. And he says that meant they were less likely to do anything about their health.
They are less likely to do physical activity, less likely to diet.
The misperception of weight was even more striking among African-American and Latino women. That surprised researchers, since nearly 4 out of 5 African-American and Latino women of reproductive age are overweight or obese. In his journal article, Rahman urged medical providers to monitor their patient's body mass index, a measure of weight and height, as routinely as they do other vital signs. But getting doctors to tackle weight loss has proved difficult.
My research showed that as providers, a lot of us are really uncomfortable talking about weight to patients.
Dr. Naomi Stotlin is an OBGYN at San Francisco General Hospital. She says white providers are especially reluctant to counsel Latino and Black women to exercise more and reduce their calories.
They felt that their messages wouldn't be taken seriously because of cultural differences and because of friends and family pressures.
They hear from their mothers, fathers, aunts, and uncles that being a bit heavier is healthy, says Stotlin. And indeed, those who study Black and Latino culture say those voices often trump the doctor's advice.
You ask me to change how I look, but yet my mother and my grandmother and my aunt and other people who are around me look like that. It's like, I'm not sure necessarily that you're very credible in telling me I need to do it, particularly if my grandmother has lived to be her 70s or 80s. It's like, I don't see the problem.
Vicki Mays directs the Center on Minority Health Disparities at UCLA. She says Black and Latino cultures don't idealize small, thin women.
They really do value women who are large. They really do value, as they say, women with meat on their bones.
May says rather than talking about weight, physicians should instead tell patients about the health risks, like cardiovascular disease and diabetes. A here's what's likely to happen to you lecture, if you will. But May says even if the message gets through, many poor Black and Latino women live in neighborhoods littered with fast food restaurants and discount grocery stores, but lacking in parks and safe streets to exercise. Back at San Francisco General, OBGYN Stotlin says those obstacles don't stop her from broaching the subject.
I'm not that concerned necessarily about the overweight woman who doesn't consider herself in that category, as long as we can have a discussion about, okay, what's your diet and physical activity? Are there ways that we can improve that?
For her part, Daisy Say says proudly that she's already lost 3 pounds just by making little changes to her diet, eating more salads and vegetables and eating less overall. It's a small victory, she concedes, on what will likely be a long road towards a healthier future. For Health Dialogues, I'm Sarah Varney.
And finally, we're joined by two folks who help young people avoid some of the problems we've been hearing about by developing healthier attitudes about themselves. Elizabeth Scott is a psychotherapist and co-founder of The Body Positive in Berkeley. They train young people to be activists against eating disorders and to promote self-respect. And also with us, Ramses Munoz, a community health coordinator for Huckleberry Youth Programs. They're a nonprofit that provides, among other things, health education and counseling to youth in the San Francisco Bay Area. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me begin with you, Elizabeth. What's the philosophy behind Body Positive and what's your mission?
The Body Positive's philosophy is to focus on the positive, to focus on giving people tools to transform the environments that they live in. We work with primary schools, secondary schools, colleges, and we have public workshops so that we can teach children to focus on beauty and focus on health rather than focusing on their flaws and transforming themselves. Help them learn that this focusing on body image is pretty much of a dead end, and instead they could focus on their purpose in life and what's important.
When you say focus on their body image, like, give me an example.
Well, just the practice that girls are raised to do where we stand in front of the mirror and tear ourselves to shreds, really looking for flaws in ourselves and then in the world looking for flaws in everyone else. The fruit of that practice is social isolation and suffering. And so we really try to show them that you can choose how you think about beauty and you can choose how you think about yourself because these are just ideas. And instead to focus on how you can create an ideal of beauty that starts with you and your culture and your ancestors and expands out from there. And so if you're looking in the mirror to see beauty and to see experience and see history, then you can start to look out in the world and appreciate the diversity and size and shape that human beings come in.
And so you're saying that that young people tend to focus on an ideal, some ideal that they see.
They're
somewhere.
Taught to. I think kids are pretty open to seeing beauty in diversity, but they're taught to focus on a very narrow ideal, which has become far further and further from what's attainable for the natural body.
And Ram says, I know that eating disorders is just one of the things that your group focuses on, but what are some of the kinds of stories you hear or problems that you encounter?
We have a workshop that's called Body Image, Body Image 101. And within this workshop, we do touch on the topic of eating disorders. But before we do that, we talk about the ideal female, the ideal male. And it's really interesting to hear how that perception changes from one neighborhood to another. In more low-income communities, where there's less access to healthcare, less access to, or there's just lower attainment of education, the youth tend to not necessarily know the language, but they do know that there is an issue. When we go to more affluent neighborhoods, there's definitely a language. It's easy to identify.
What do you mean by that, a language?
In terms of the kids knowing what to call an eating disorder or how many eating disorders are out there or in that type of way.
And you say there are differences in neighborhoods. Does that mean there are differences among different races and different ethnic groups as well? In terms of body image.
In terms of body image, just the stuff that they bring up. I think, for instance, when we do the ideal male, ideal female activity in more low-income communities, it's okay to be bigger. And, you know, they say things like bigger breast and bigger behind.
And that's acceptable?
And that's really acceptable, right?
Or even desired.
Right. And then in neighborhoods where it's more affluent, the standard of beauty is really, really slim, really skinny. And I think that tends to affect how we talk about eating disorders. People get, you know, really shocked in terms of how these both extremes can still lead to not being able to diagnose certain people or at least to talk about.
What do you mean by extremes?
Well, so if in one area it's a norm to be really skinny, they're less likely to question eating disorders that promote that, where people are really, really skinny. In other neighborhoods where people are bigger or thicker, how they say, I think it would be more difficult for kids to see that there's also an issue there, an overeating. Those are some of the things that we tend to see.
Yeah, Elizabeth, did you
No matter what the social ideal of beauty, which is, it's really helpful to recognize how it's varied amongst different cultural groups, because it helps to teach kids that it's really socially constructed. They're inventing it. Mm-hmm. But beyond championing a certain look, if you're focused on transforming your body as a way of dealing with your distress is not going to be improved. And so what we try to teach at the Body Positive is we ask a question in the groups at schools. If it weren't about your body, what might your distress really be about? Because you might be trying to get thicker or you might be trying to get thinner. Neither of those will solve the problems that you're having in your life.
What kind of answers do you get to that question?
Well, I had a girl who once said, I got it, when she came to group. And she said, I was looking at my thighs and my father was yelling at me and I was thinking, my thighs are so fat. And then I heard your voice and you said, if it weren't about your body, what might it be about? She said, well, the problem is my dad's a d-. He has to stop yelling at me. That was the problem. And if she's trying to change her thighs, it will never resolve the violence in her family.
That's an example of somebody other than, you know, the young person's self. It's a parent. But what about issues around self-esteem, for example? How common is that? And how does that relate to this?
Well, it certainly does relate. And parents will ask, isn't she just starving to get attention? And I'll say, perhaps. Can she have some? Because attention is something that kids need and human beings need. Right after food, air, water, we need attention. And a lot of what we do in the Body Positive groups is just give kids attention. We'll give each other attention where they get listened to. What are the real sources of their distress and what developmental skills do they need to learn to really overcome them in their lives? Like how to communicate to your dad rather than running up and down a hill trying to make your thighs smaller, which won't solve that problem.
And Ramses Munoz, what differences do you see among boys and girls, young men and young women, in terms of their willingness to talk about these things and the kinds of issues they're dealing with?
I also run a men's group at a local high school. And it's really evident that as men, we just don't talk about it. But we are dealing with it as well. Even now more than 10 years ago, boys also have this pressure and to look and have the abs and have the chest and be really athletic. And I think recently I just did a workshop with a couple with these boys and on dating and healthy relationships. And it was really exciting to hear them express some of their fears and being rejected because they didn't fit a specific body type. And I think that also lends itself to promote, certain eating disorders with boys.
It absolutely does. And boys are getting eating disorders more than ever and also younger. And I think it's really important, no matter what the goal for the boys or the girls, it's a similar issue. It's like they're having issues about their confidence about dating. And if they translate that into, if I just transform my body, then the girls will like me, they're going to miss developing the skills of communication and relatedness and, kindness that help you cultivate a relationship. And it's also dangerous. You don't want to solve your problem by starving because eating disorders are life-threatening. It's not a good strategy for coping.
Elizabeth Scott, so many young people nowadays are online, either on Facebook or MySpace, whatever it might be. What's your impression of how those different social networking sites, fuel these sorts of issues or address them?
They can be incredibly destructive, like the pro-ana sites where you can go find out how to be more eating disordered.
Pro-ana meaning pro-anorexia.
Anorexia, but they could also be the way that we try to use them at the Body Positive is to create materials and create media. We put clips online. We have a lot of Facebook activity. We have a blog about positive body image. We're trying to give a positive message. There's nothing about those media that are inherently one way or the other. We can certainly push it towards a more positive use, and it can be a very powerful way to reach kids because they're interested in video and music and dialogue rather than a lecture.
Lecture, yeah. So it's a way to draw them
in. It's a way to draw them in, and they will contribute. And one of our young college women has a blog on Facebook for the Body Positive, and it's so lively and interactive. And that's what will get kids interested in changing their idea from how to perfect themselves to instead how to express themselves.
Well, speaking of online, we got some responses from our listeners and people who look at our website online. And let me just read one or two of them to you and get your thoughts about it. Linda in Daly City wrote to us, and she said that she still partakes in some level of disordered eating, but her habits are much healthier than they used to be. She said she struggled with disordered eating since the eighth grade, but disordered eating wasn't diagnosed or addressed until she was in her early 20s. And then she writes, "My treatment has definitely been a roller coaster because of cost reasons." She says that her biggest challenge is accepting my body for what it is right now. There's a whole lot in that, Elizabeth, but what jumps out at you?
I would say to her, go ahead and get completely free. And it doesn't have to be expensive. It doesn't have to be isolated in a one-to-one therapy. Start a group. Start a group, a body positive group, where you're building a community of peers that support loving your body, enjoying your food, having a peaceful relationship to food, and addressing the real problems and getting support for that. And you can do that for free.
Ram says you deal with communities of folks who have a lot of issues going on at once, mm-hmm. not just eating disorders. How do some of the other issues that you deal with in the different groups that Huckleberry puts on, how do those things interact with one another?
Sure. When we do our workshop on body image and eating disorders, we also talk about substance use because a lot of kids who are feeling bad about the way they look or whatever their diet might be like, they cope by smoking marijuana, drinking alcohol, or smoking tobacco. Those are and then ecstasy. Those are some of the four most common substances used by youth who abuse these substances. And we always try to promote in our workshops a healthier view of yourself. We have this one workshop that's called Beauty Around the World. We like to talk about standards of beauty, in other countries. And at the end, we give them these little slips, like three slips. And at the end, they have this person with all these different body parts. And it's really powerful to see them and kind of like look at this person and, you know, this character and hear what they have to say about how they wouldn't be used to, you know, having big hips or a really light face, you know, or stretched out earlobes or stretched out lips or, you know, stretched out necks. And, you know, that these are things that happen today. And so, or tattoos around their bodies.
Yeah.
That really brings a whole nother perspective for them.
Elizabeth Scott, there's also at the, right now, I mean, there is a real problem that we hear more and more about, which is obesity. I mean, there are a lot of overweight people, and some of them are teenagers and young adults. How do you balance that message and the concern about that with these other disordered eating concerns, you know, about anorexia and so
on? We give the same message to the fat kid as the middle-sized kid as the skinny kid. We are very concerned that the anti-obesity campaign is promoting eating disorders. We're interested in what promotes improved self-care in all children. Clearly, body dissatisfaction and dieting is clearly linked with other high-risk behaviors like drug use, dating, violence, having safe sex. If you hate your body, why take care of it? So we're interested in what motivates self-care in the skinny kid, the middle-sized kid, and the fat kid. We know that shaming and isolating the fat child will not improve his self-care. So we're interested in what will improve his self-care. And what we've found is what improves it is valuing yourself. Again, cultivating an ideal of beauty that starts where you are, even if it's fat. We believe that the social justice concerns of fat children, that they're not humiliated and persecuted, are very closely connected to eating disorders prevention, because this middle-sized kid and the skinny kid is going to try to get as far away from that status as they can get. And that's dead. I mean, of all the way, how thin do you have to be to never be criticized? And so what promotes improved self-care is self-love, an ideal of beauty that includes you, community that supports that adventure, you know, really focusing on looking for beauty and improving healthy eating. And if we don't focus on weight loss, we can improve the health outcomes for all kids. If you focus on weight loss, the kid may improve his, eat his veggies and exercise better, but not drop weight. And then he'll say to himself, well, that didn't work. I quit. Back to the couch and the potato chips. And we don't want that. We want to say, no, it's the behaviors we're after. And you can improve your health. And whatever size you end up, that's how the ball bounces. But focusing on weight loss has the opposite effect, where you get the kids who started in the obesity program and they end up in the eating disorders program. And that we want to avoid that.
Elizabeth Scott with The Body Positive and Ramses Munoz with Huckleberry Youth Programs. Thanks both very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Health Dialogues. Don't forget, you'll find lots more information at our website, photos and extended interviews, along with links to this topic and many others. You'll find it all at healthdialogues.org. While you're there, you can listen to our show, subscribe to the podcast, and of course, you can get involved in the conversation. We also hope you'll check out our blog. It's called Our State of Health, and it features voices from communities all over the state writing about health issues where they live. You can read about a farmer's market in Old Town Salinas, people heading to Mexico for medical help, and the Hmong community in Oroville. Again, that's at healthdialogues.org. And be sure to join us in March as Health Dialogues looks at medical mistakes. Health Dialogues is a production of the California Report and KQED Public Radio. The director is Susie Racho. Paul Encore is our engineer today, and we had additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The Health Dialogues team includes senior online editor Gabriel Cohen, web producer Nick Vidinsky, and outreach coordinator Shuka Kalantari. The senior producer is Polly Stryker. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report's Health Dialogue series are provided by the California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health happens.
More information at calendow.org. And the members of KQED Public Radio.